you're struggling with drugs, alcohol, gambling or food, or concerned about somebody who is, tune into the Living Free show on 3CR at 1pm every Thursday.
I don't know how I got there, but and I couldn't stop it.
I had stopped expecting that anybody cared.
Never enough. I'm never enough. It's never enough. He's never enough.
That was the confusion.
Tune in to Living Free, stories of recovery from addictive behaviour, Thursdays at 1pm on 3CR. Or listen at 3CR on digital radio or podcasts and live streaming on 3cr.org.au.
Being able to centre myself and be okay in myself and turn my world around.
Living Free. Welcome to the Living Free show on 3CR Community Radio, 855 kilohertz on your AM dial. I'm Anne. I'd like to acknowledge the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation, traditional owners of the land from which 3CR transmits people-powered radio. We'd like to pay our respects to elders past and present and to acknowledge that the material and spiritual connection of Aboriginal people to this land was stolen from them. Each week on the Living Free show, we showcase one of the many programs that assist in recovery from drug, alcohol, gambling, food and other addictions. Our guests share their recovery stories and highlight that shared experience saves lives. Before we start, I'd like to remind you that the Living Free show may involve discussion of topics such as suicide, mental illness, self-harm and family violence. Please practice self-care and care of others when listening. Today in the studio, I'm joined by Glenda. Glenda is a member of both Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon family groups, so she has lived experience of both dependence on alcohol and of being in relationship with someone else who has their own problem with alcoholism. So welcome, Glenda.
Thank you. Thanks, Anne.
It's really great to have you on the show.
Thank you.
And really great to have what they call in the fellowships a double winner and a member of the beverage program, as some people call it, as well as Al-Anon, because normally in this slot we're just talking Al-Anon. But hopefully we'll hear your whole story of how you lived and then got into AA and then got into Al-Anon. Would you be able to just tell us a little bit about where you grew up?
Well, I grew up in Frankston. I was born in Frankston. I went to the local primary school, and I also went to the local high school, Frankston High School. I worked my first jobs in Frankston. My job in a milk bar and my job in a hairdresser's when I was, you know, probably 15 and 16 years of age on a Saturday. And, I completed intermediate level, which is, you know, fourth year of high school. And I didn't have very much idea of what I wanted to do with my life.
Well, there's two Frankston girls there with us, with you today out there in the audience land. I had my first job in Frankston too. I think my third job in Frankston was in the Pier Hotel. all right, so here's life according to the two Frankston girls. Would you tell us a little bit about your childhood? Was there any drinking in your childhood, adults drinking?
I don't remember drinking in my childhood that was anything unusual or abnormal. So it's been an interesting journey for me, especially with Al-Anon, trying to identify where the alcoholism is in the family, because I feel like surely I'm not the only one. So I had a very stable mother and father, but perhaps not a very emotionally supportive mother, and I think that's because she probably kept everything to herself because of what I'm hearing from my sister was possibly the alcoholism of her father. And might explain that when I came into AA, I've been in and out of Al-Anon for probably 40 years. But when I came back and identified, I identified as an adult child, and I thought, well, that doesn't make any sense. But in a way, it does make sense, because my mother was probably affected by, most definitely affected by her father, and they did have a family dynamic which included mental health issues as well. So, I can't quite remember what your question was.
That's all
right. I did have quite a I had a fairly tumultuous childhood, in spite of the stability of my parents.
Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, I can tell you about that. First of all, I was born with dislocated hips. They call it hip dysplasia these days. Nobody really understood what it was. Nobody knew what it was, so it wasn't until I was 18 months old and somebody came up to my mother on the beach and said, would you like to know what the problem is with your daughter? I always remember that as when I've been told is what's wrong, because that's played into my life down the track. But anyway, this lady told my mother, and then my mother took action, and it meant that I had to go into hospital at 18 months of age. So it meant that I was separated from my parents at 18 months of age, and I have only just understood really in the last couple of years how much insecurity that I was very affected by that insecurity, and have probably carried that right the way through my life.
As a trauma?
As a trauma, yeah. And especially back then, I was born in 1951, so there was no such thing as parents going into hospital and staying overnight. And lovely homeopath explained to me that, you know, I would have felt the feelings in my body without being able to think them in my mind. And I know that when I did finally go home, I called my mother nurse.
Oh.
So that must have been really hurtful for her. Mm. But I guess it also signified who I went to for, you know, who my main caregivers were, and they were nurses. I had to have my hips broken and reset, and then another whole period of time where even after I got home I had to stay in a cot. I wasn't allowed out of the cot. And then I ended up in boots and bars and calipers. And the one thing that I can remember is that we were at a bus stop in Mount Eliza, and I think we might have been going into the Royal Children's Hospital. The hospital I was in was in Mount Eliza. It was the orthopaedic hospital then in Mount Eliza, and it was, you know, only really across the road from where my grandparents and my mum and dad were living. And we went to get on the bus, and my mother tried to help me get on the bus, and I said, I can do it, I can do it. So I had this determination and a fierce independence, I suppose, mixed up with this, as I came to know myself as I got older, insecurity. And that was one trauma, but I did have another trauma, which when I was nine, which really affected me hugely. I was very sensitive, and I had to have my appendix out, and I disappeared into a great big black hole when they gave me the anaesthetic. Back then, the anaesthetics aren't the same as what they are now, and I was given ether. And I just spun into this huge black hole, and I thought I was dying. And I came out of that surgery, being very afraid of death and dying. And it was a trauma that I carried with me until I was 21. And a marriage guidance counsellor that I was seeing sent me to this psychiatrist, and he gave me a drug. And the drug just kind of stopped the fear, which sounds incredible, but that's what happened. Later on in my recovery, I've been able to think about what my ideas of life and death and, you know, philosophically what I believe in. And I've been able to formulate my idea of what it is I'm doing in the world, why I need to be here, and what death is for me. Mm. And because it's been such a huge thing, I don't think about death every day, but death is not very far away from my thoughts because of the trauma that I went through. I met an elderly couple, or I met an elderly lady. The lady had actually been the secretary and the wife of I'm going to call him an optician, but that doesn't give him the right kind of credit. He was seeing my daughter because my daughter had a turn in her eye, and she had it corrected a couple of times. And she was telling me that her husband wasn't well, and she was so shocked that because all they'd had all their lives was good health. Mm. And I thought, oh, my God, how can somebody get to being in what I imagined then was close, you know, in their 80s and not have ever contemplated this? And I've been contemplating it most of my life. So I'm very, very grateful that I've been able to deal with all of that.
Mm.
Yeah.
Well, that's a really compelling story of what makes a human being, what forms us.
Yeah. Yes, it is.
It is, isn't it?
Yeah.
We're going to have a little break.
Okay.
And we're going to come back and hear more of that journey.
Okay, thank you.
Get lost in science.
Tune in to 3CR every week to hear
Beth,
Chris
and Stuart
discuss news and issues from the universe that is science.
Get informed and learn a bit more about the world around you. Lost in Science can be heard every Thursday at 8:30 in the morning and is repeated the following Tuesday at 6 a.m.
Word to the nerd. You can also download a podcast. Go to the website at www.3cr.org.au and get lost in science.
Help us stay radical. Become a regular donor to 3CR. A regular donor is someone who loves 3CR so much that they set up an automatic donation to 3CR on the same day every month. Will you help 3CR by becoming a regular donor today? Together, we can keep independent voices on air. Go to 3cr.org.au.
This is a Living Free show on 3CR 855 kHz on your AM radio dial, and 3CR on digital radio. If you would like to listen to one of our many podcasts, then you can find us on your preferred podcast platform, or just Google 3CR Living Free and check out our website. You can also contact us via phone or email. Today I'm chatting with Glenda, and she's just told us the story of her childhood, which was completely informed by two traumatic experiences around hospitals. And now, Glenda, if you would take us up to your adult life and tell us your AA story. How did it all start?
Alcohol. Yeah, okay. So I didn't have much of an idea of being anyone in particular. I didn't know that I didn't have any self-esteem, but basically I had no self-esteem. And there'd been, you know, my family drank, but just socially, and I had had social drinks. I remember that my grandmother, when I was very small, thought it would be very good for me to have a little glass, a little small, like Vegemite-sized glass, or probably smaller, probably much smaller than that, of stout to help me with my appetite. being a firstborn, I think everybody was sort of a bit on edge, and I probably just wanted to play rather than eat. And maybe my falling over because of my hip dysplasia probably, I don't know how that played into things. But anyway, but what I can say, the thing that sticks out to me most is that at 17, me and my girlfriends and I went down to the local bottle shop, which was sort of off a bridge and near Frankston, because there was a dance in Frankston called Penny Lane. And we were going, and I was so shy and I really wanted to dance. And so I drank the best part of a bottle of something called Tosca, which must have been so revolting. Of course, I didn't know that the amount that I'd had to drink was as much as it was until I tried to cross the Nepean Highway to get to the dance, and then I realised that I'd had quite a lot to drink. And the consequence was that I didn't dance the way I wanted to dance. I wasn't the wallflower, but I did drink. Sorry, I'm saying drink. I did dance like an elephant. and the upshot of that was that I think that's the huge don't care factor, but I mean, I think that is just the effect that the alcohol had on me. It definitely wasn't in my plan to dance like an elephant. But I went outside at one stage, and there were police outside. They wanted to know how old I was. I couldn't add up. I was trying to make myself 19 instead of 17, or at least 18, but I made myself 16. So not a very good start to a drinking career. And because there was a boy hanging around who was actually my girlfriend's boyfriend, and he wanted to take me for a walk to sober me up, they thought that he might have had other ideas, and they decided they should take me home. So the police, and I begged them to lock me up, please.
Rather than take you to your parents?
Yes, I was very afraid of being taken home to my parents. And we've talked about shame a bit earlier today. Probably had a lot of shame about where I was, and I would have liked them not to have known. But they took me home. Eventually I had to tell them where I lived, and they took me home. And to this day I can't really remember whether it was my mother or father who answered the door. I'm pretty sure it was my mother. And they said, "Here's your daughter, and she's been hanging around with a drug pusher."
Oh.
And the person in me that didn't want to take responsibility for what happened just appeared out of out of a puff of smoke, and I told my parents it was their fault.
Your parents' fault?
Yeah, I told
straight
them
away.
Yeah, straight away. Straight away. Like, no mucking around. Yes, I'd had a discussion with my mother after my traumatic surgery and the fear of death and dying, and I tried to discuss it with my mother, and my mother had said something not very supportive, and so I understood that I couldn't go to my mother with these problems. So I guess it was easy, having been drunk, to then start the blame game, which of course I eventually had to stop. So do you want to move ahead a bit faster?
Not at all. I'd like, well, what No. But just take us to where your drinking progressed and how unmanageable it became.
Yeah. Well, I think it was unmanageable enough at that moment.
That point, straight away.
But, of course, I didn't know about alcoholism and I didn't know that I was an alcoholic and I didn't go out and drink every day after that. But what happened was when I went to parties and things, I drank, and I do believe now that looking back, the reason for drinking was to help me fit in. I was never a life of the party kind of gal. I just needed to fit in. I just needed to have enough. I don't even think I consciously was aware of what I was doing with alcohol. My drinking only spanned, and my drinking and my drug taking only spanned from the age of 17 to 27. It was only 10 years. So I did a lot of damage in that 10 years. And I'd been somewhere and smoked dope with a group of people and thought, what a waste of time this is. But it was smoking dope that actually really brought me to my knees.
Really?
It wasn't. It could have been. It could have just as well been alcohol. But I think even unconsciously I knew that I was getting into trouble with alcohol, physical trouble. But I got into a lot more trouble between my ears with smoking dope, and a few other drugs that I took also didn't help. And I ended up with a drug-induced schizophrenia. What I understood to be a drug-induced schizophrenia, I had a psychiatrist tell me that I was a paranoid schizophrenic, and I got kind of manipulated into going into Larundel, which no longer exists, as a kind of a forced voluntary patient. But I ended up back in Larundel because of the progression of my disease, the fact that I'd had a child in amongst all of this to try and help me make sense of my life, and a suicide attempt, mm-hmm. because I just felt so unworthy, so completely unworthy. My mother had been up to get, I was living in Collingwood, my mother had been up and taken my daughter back to her place, and with mum and dad, I'm very thankful she did that. And it was only in the next week or two when my partner said, why don't you go back to your family, blood's thicker than water. And I felt so embarrassed. I think I wore his clothes because I didn't have any clean clothes to wear, and I just couldn't stand the shame of it. And I threw myself off a train on the way down to Frankston, and here I still am, which is I was very angry. I woke up very angry, mm-hmm. But that also taught me a huge lesson eventually about the fact that I was meant to be here, and I wasn't to just, I mean, it's very strange, isn't it, a person that is so terribly afraid of death and dying, which I still was then, and probably a lot of that had been numbed by, you know, the drink and the drugs that I had taken. But in the end, it didn't stop me from wanting to kill myself because I just felt so bad about who I was.
Is this when you're 27 then, around that late 20s?
Probably 25 because 18 months later, after I think there was 4 months in Larundel as a forced patient, as a committed patient, I had time at home with my parents on major tranquilizers, mm-hmm. and antipsychotic medication before I got sober.
That's heavy story, but common story in AA. We if anyone's out there feeling a bit concerned about any of this, I have misplaced my some numbers that people can call if you are thinking in a suicidal way. So if you just stay until we play a song, and then I'll find my phone numbers and you can call. But anyway, call Lifeline, call AA, call the suicide helpline if there's anything that's triggering you at the moment. So Glenda, can you I'm intrigued by this low self-esteem that came from, even though you've got a fairly stable family, the low self-esteem seems to be, to me, actually I'll just ask you, is it linked to the trauma, or is it something you've brought into the world with you? Or
I think without being blaming anybody in particular, because, you know, I've learnt about blame, even though I blamed my parents for the very first night that I drank. I learned very, very, very early on that I had an epiphany. I can tell you about my epiphany if you like. But I learned during that epiphany, actually, that I had made such a mess of my life with my young daughter, and it was much worse than what my parents had, done to me. Done to me is not a very nice way of expressing it, because what they did was really their very best.
The very best.
And, you know, we all have traumas. I know my mother, I believe my mother was brought up in a difficult household, and my father not so much, but I'm completely lost now. I did have to stop blaming, and I did stop blaming, and that did help, but I'm completely lost.
I'd love to hear about the epiphany after the break, but in the lead up to the break, because this is important for the audience to hear, you talked about as an alcoholic in that 10 years from the age of 17 to 27, that you did a lot of damage, I presume, to yourself and possibly to other people. I don't want to preempt what you might be going to say, but can you just talk about the kind of damage that you're talking about there?
I think that I was just... I think the damage was about not being able to take responsibility. Although I was working, I have various jobs. I didn't ever drink with those jobs. I had a job in the pub. There was no drinking. I think that the worst thing that happened was the state of mind I had that made me make a decision to get pregnant and have a child.
So that was a decision? You thought that was going to be part of the answer to what ailed you?
To help me take responsibility for my life. And I think today that it was a very selfish decision, but I never didn't want my daughter, but at the same time I was not able to give her the love and the care and the support that I would have. I would have liked to give, I would have loved to give. I don't, but, you know, having being unwell and then having another responsibility only made things worse. And I have a lot of shame, which I have forgiven myself for as much as is possible to forgive myself for. It's been a long time coming, and it hasn't gone away. I mentioned in an AA meeting yesterday that I was, I didn't know if I was ever going to be able to fully forgive myself. I think it's something women that carry babies in their wombs have an innate desire to treat themselves respectfully, and I don't believe that I was well enough to treat myself respectfully. And I gave birth to my daughter at 7 months, and I really don't feel like, you know, I was eating properly. It's really traumatic. Talking about traumas, I guess it's been a really traumatic part of my life. That is something that I just cannot take away. I can't remove it. The only thing I can do is keep hearing people when they tell me that I must forgive myself, and I see myself walking further and further down the track of forgiveness, because I see that when I don't, and if I don't, I don't allow my daughter the dignity to live her life being fully responsible for herself, even though she is. And, you know, I can thank Al-Anon for a lot of that support. I think my letting go and my trusting that she has the resources to do what she needs to do for herself and her life are really important resources to give. And only a few nights ago, I was upset about something she'd said, and I think I was in her orbit when I was a little bit too tired and a bit too sensitive and probably taking on things that I need not have. And I talked about it with her, and she said, "Mum, I just told, you know, my friend how much I love you. So if I try to blame myself to my daughter, she gets really quite upset with me. She has been a huge support to me through my sobriety, and I've probably mentioned my blaming self to her more than was necessary for somebody that is in a program. I think the grief sometimes has outweighed the ability to stop myself from blaming myself to her. So I rarely, if ever, do that anymore. The last time I did it, I said, okay, not doing that again. But it's been a big process of letting go and trusting and believing that a God of my understanding, which is, you know, we're taught in AA and in Al-Anon, our God can be anything, and you don't even have to use the word God. But if I didn't have a spirituality as a big part of my recovery, I doubt very much that I'd be here. My epiphany probably speaks very much so of that.
We're going to leave it there for a little break. Thank you so much for being so candid. Telling the story of a million mothers out there, I think, including myself. I also have apologised far too much. We'll have a little break. We'll play a song by Tin Pan Orange called Ordinary Lives, and then we'll be right back.
Help us stay radical. Become a regular donor to 3CR. A regular donor is someone who loves 3CR so much that they set up an automatic donation to 3CR on the same day every month. Throughout September, we're asking you to become a regular donor. By setting up an ongoing automatic monthly donation, you'll help provide a stable foundation for 3CR. If we know we can count on your donation every month, it means we can better plan and resource our broadcasting. Whether it's First Nations justice, workers' rights, climate action, independent music, housing advocacy, or disability activism, your regular support ensures that these movements and struggles have a platform every single week. 3CR is determined to stay independent. This means we don't rely on corporate sponsorship or government funding. We serve our community, not corporate interests. But this also means we do rely on people like you to keep the station running. From paying the bills to maintaining our studios to training the next generation of community broadcasters, 3CR relies on community donations to survive. By becoming a regular donor, you can help us stay resilient and radical. Will you help 3CR by becoming a regular donor today? Together, we can keep independent voices on air. Go to 3cr.org.au.
Justice, diversity, community, politics, sport.
Join us every Thursday afternoon at 4 p.m.
No, no, no. We now start at 3:30 for an hour.
For the Sporting Record.
Or check out the Sporting Record podcasts available on Spotify, Apple, 3cr.org, wherever.
Baseball. Basketball.
This is the Living Free Show on 3CR Digital Radio and live streaming on 3cr.org.au/streaming. And we're talking with Glenda about recovery, basically, I think, from intergenerational alcoholism, trauma, and her own alcoholism and drug use. Before we go on, I would like to give you some numbers to call if you've feeling any sort of distress yourself around these issues. So obviously, if there's an emergency, call 000. If it's depression, anxiety, etc., call Beyond Blue, 1300 22 4636, Lifeline 131114. If you're affected by what's complex mental health issues, you can call SANE 1800 187 263. And if you're worried about your parenting, you can call, and your kids anywhere from birth to 18 years, you can call 132289, and that's Parent Line. So never do any of this suffering on your own. It's is a message that we hear a lot in the 12 steps. We don't have to do it alone, do we, Glenda? No. Can you talk a little bit about that, actually? That's something you probably know about.
Yeah. Yeah, not doing it alone. I think for me, finding out when I went into my rehab that I remember reading a spiel that was written in a brochure. I was in a fellowship called Who's Fellowship. It was called We Help Ourselves, and it was in New South Wales. And I'm feel it does still exist, as far as I know, and probably in a very different format to what it was back in 1978. I got sober. Yes, I remember reading this thing and thinking, "Oh my goodness, this is saying exactly what I need. This is where I fit." But even before that, you know, I'd met a girl that had been in that program, and I'd met her at a community house in Frankston. And the lady that I spoke to in the community house said to me, "What is it you want? What would you like?" And I was very good at just being able to talk, maybe like I'm talking now and sounding like I know something. And I said to her, "I'd like a friend. I need a friend." I said, "As someone that isn't straight and isn't using drugs." And, you know, really, when I think about it, I was asking to meet a sober alcoholic, somebody who isn't straight and not using drugs, fellow alcoholic addict. And this woman said, "Oh, I know just the person." And I guess that's why the belief in the higher power is also part of not doing it on my own or on our own. Anyway, I met this girl, and it was because of her and me visiting her every week while I was still living with my parents and on all these, you know, psychiatric medications, that I would visit her and we would talk, and it was because of her I knew where I could go when I'd made that decision. And yes, my epiphany was really about being in my mother's laundry and looking down into what looked like a pit of hell. I think it was the hell in my own mind. I'm not really a believer in hell in that respect, but I could see myself very clearly and see my fear and see see my fear that it had stopped me progressing in my life, the fear of death and dying, the resentment on my parents that I needed to let go of, and that if there was going to be a world war, I was very scared of world wars, brought up in the time where people were talking about the atomic bomb, much as they almost are now,
too much.
Yet the difference between me now and then is very different. It stopped me living my life. My having that epiphany and knowing that I needed to face up, and going into this rehab, like it wasn't easy for me in the rehab. Most of the people in the rehab I was in were heroin addicts, and they seemed like quite normal people to me. I mean, there was no drugs there.
Have you gone in for your alcohol at this point, or your drug use?
I think the drug use, mm-hmm. because I don't think at the time I don't think I understood I was an alcoholic, it was only during this program when some AA members came to talk to us about the first step that I understood that I was powerless over alcohol and my life had become unmanageable. I think it's really it's very interesting that my thoughts around it were, I'm an alcoholic. Well, what will I do if I can't drink? Mm-hmm. And it was sort of a shock for me to hear myself say that and realise that I couldn't pick up a drink a day at a time. I just understood that intuitively and in my gut at the moment without really recognising a whole alcohol story that was in there with the using of drugs and the reasons. It's, you know, they say in AA it's not how much you use, it's what it does to you, the effect it has on you, and that it says in the big book of AA that, you know, women are gone in only a few years, whereas it can take men a lot longer and, you know, bigger quantities of alcohol to drink before they hit their rock bottom. But mine was hit well and truly, and I suppose because of my traumas very early on, and probably because I was female. You know, I don't think I used a lot of drugs either, but the drugs that I used affected me very quickly, and very detrimentally. So, I wasn't a great talker in that fellowship. I think I spent a lot of time feeling my own inadequacy, but I'm very grateful for it too, because it was there, it was a rock, and I was dry. I was no longer taking my psychiatric medication. I detoxed myself off one lot, and the other lot was an injection I had in my bum. And I guess I should caution people here that just because I did something like this, I'm not recommending that anybody else do it, because it, you know, they say do these things with doctor's support, and I did not. And this place I was going to was a non-medicated detox, so I detoxed off this drug that I used to get an injection in my bum. And that wasn't pleasant, it wasn't easy, but I still was supported by having that network around me, even though I had difficulty connecting with people. I think the best thing that happened to me was that I understood that because of the AA members coming and talking to us, and I think even the director of the program said, you don't expect to get any long-term sobriety unless you use a 12-step fellowship and go to at least 3 meetings a week. They say to do a lot more these days. People say these days go to 90 meetings in 90 days. But that's what I was told, and that's pretty much what I did. And I was very grateful. Like, I knew that I needed to stay sober. I knew that I wanted a life, and that really probably I'd been brought up to be more than what had become of me. So I was going to do what I was told. I don't like the word told. My sponsor in AA used to say it's a suggested program, Glenda. It's not a telling program. And I do try and still live by that today. Take on board the suggestions, take on board the steps and traditions. But I have to say that I've been, you know, quite backward in going forward in my relationships. It's taken me a long time to get trust in my relationships with people. And I think that especially since COVID and Zoom, when, you know, we were able to do and still can, thankfully, do Zoom meetings and not go to a physical meeting, slowly, I've brought, I've got quite a network of friends that I can communicate with. I still tend to communicate my deepest needs to one person. I had one friend in primary school and that I grew up next to, and one friend in high school. And I could have had more, but that's me. I'm, you know, I like to just have one friend. But I have many people that I could actually turn to today, and I know they would all support me. So I have, and I've grown to like and even maybe love AA in a way that that is different to how I've been. It's been, I must go because I must stay sober. I think that I'm growing to love people more, and because I'm letting them into my life more. And I mean, I haven't mentioned a lot about Al-Anon, but without Al-Anon, I would have not have been able to manage my life with my son, who I haven't really talked about, even though that's definitely not a win-win situation today. It is I have been very, very much supported by Al-Anon, especially in this last 2 or 3 years when he decided to walk away from my life. And that has been incredibly hard. And I did the very typical blame thing. But really what I understand today is that he is a victim of this disease too, whether he is an alcoholic or whether he has just inherited what we call the ism, you know, the attitudes and of this disease. I'm able today to let go and to leave him be until he or I decide that there's an action that needs to be taken. I'm very, very grateful for Al-Anon for that and for helping me with my partner. When you ask me about damage, I damaged my partner. My partner now is my daughter's father, and we found each other again. And both of us said to each other early in our re-relationship that I definitely felt like I owed my partner an amends for not really allowing him to see his child until she was 16, and I'd broken up with my then husband, who is complicated business having a disease and being part of this fellowship. But the thing that isn't complicated is the simplicity of the program. Really, it's simple. They say it's not easy, but it's simple. And I have a life today. I do have a quality of life and living today that would have been impossible for me to experience without putting down the drink, the drugs, and also without the support of Al-Anon and Al-Anon members, and being able to do service too. Service has been an amazing thing. Since I've been back in Al-Anon, I took on a secretaryship almost straight away because somebody said, oh, the meeting will close, and I thought, well, that's no good. So I took on a secretaryship, and that's been very good for me. And I'm very fortunate, actually, because I've been in and out of Al-Anon for 40 years, that the people that a part of the meeting that I go to now have also been in Al-Anon, not in and out like me, but for, you know, for the best part of 40 plus years. And I've known them for a long time. So, and my ability to relate to them has improved since I walked away from Al-Anon, as I, you know, did last time, to my detriment, because during COVID, my son and I had different ideas about what was the right and the wrong thing to do. It's happened to a lot of people.
So many families.
Too many. Just, yeah. Anyway, that if I had had Alan on at the time, I probably wouldn't have said a couple of things that I said to my son that he took huge offence to. And so it's been a big lesson for me to learn. And, you know, I just hope and pray he can understand, as I came to understand, that parents aren't always responsible for everything that happens. And at the end of the day, we're human beings and we all make mistakes. I didn't want to make any of the mistakes I thought my mother and father had made with me. I just made different ones,
That's
you know,
right.
even as a sober person, because I've had so much to learn.
Mm-hmm.
And, I'm really grateful. Thank you.
Well, I'm really grateful that you've come into to 3CR today, and I'm sure people listening were grateful to hear that story. Thank you, Glenda.
Thank you.
That is all we've got time for. If you're concerned about drinking in a relative or friend and would like to find out more about Al-Anon family groups, then you can phone them on 1300 252 666 or go online at alanon.org.au. I haven't got AA's number there, so sorry about that. Balanwa's next, Spirit of Wah, hosted by Uncle Tao Jim Choco Edwards. Join Uncle Choco on a journey of belonging and movement through sing-alongs and yarns. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and stay tuned now for more Radical Radio on 3CR. And I'd like to read out some of these numbers again. If you're depressed, it's Beyond Blue, 1-300-22-4636, Lifeline 13-11-14, Complex Mental Health Issues, SANE 1-800-187-263, and it's been a big theme today, parenting. Parenting is a very difficult thing. If you're struggling with that today, and you would like support, and your child's from birth to 18 years, 13 22 89. Thank you, and bye for now.